This is Terror House Radio with Matt Forney and Bryden Proctor.
Yeah, welcome to it. Terror House Radio, episode number 46. I'm Matt Forney, your charming and loquacious host, and the founder and editor-in-chief of Terror House Press. My co-host and producer, Bryden Proctor, will not be joining us this episode. He's off being gay or something. But we're going to have a good show anyway, because my guest for this program is TJ Martinell. He is an author, journalist, and most importantly, he is the author of Terror House's next book, The Pilgrim's Digress, which will be out this Friday, Christmas Day. The Pilgrim's Digress is a post-dystopian novel. Novella. That's how TJ describes it. It is imagining what could be a potential future for the United States, given the path that this country is currently on. It's a very good book. We actually serialized it earlier in the year, if you want to check that out, but soon enough you will be able to own a physical copy in your hands. I'll be talking to TJ about that and about other things. And I also want to inform you that, as I said, the book The Pilgrim's Digress will be on sale on Christmas Day. It will be 40% off, I believe. We will also be running a sale on all of our other books. So you can go crazy. You can go crazy with Terror House. Everything will be on sale. I know you kids are going to be getting... Santa's going to be leaving you some Amazon gift cards and Barnes & Noble gift cards in your stocking. And you can spend them at Terror House Press with our upcoming discounts. But enough of that. We got TJ Martinell coming right up. Stay tuned. TJ, welcome to Terror House Radio, and thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Now, I imagine some of our... You've been a prolific contributor to Terror House magazine for some time now. This is The Pilgrim's Digress is the first book of yours that you've published, and you have a bit of a public profile yourself with your own site, and you've published other books before. But for the people in the audience who don't know who you are, could you just kind of give the Cliff's Notes version of yourself, your work, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm an author, writer, and reporter originally from the Seattle area. I now live in the Cascade Mountains outside of a tourist town, a Bavarian-themed tourist town. And I've written a variety of books on exploring the issue of just dystopian themes. I've also written a bunch of short stories for Terror House that deals with the dystopian genre. And that exploration is what ultimately led me to writing this novella, The Pilgrim's Digress.
Yeah. Your work generally focuses on... Potential futures for the United States, and for, I guess, the Western world in general. In fact, before we began serializing The Pilgrim's Digress, you wrote an opinion piece for Terror House called The Dystopian Genre is Dead, which you kind of give your opinion on why dystopia, as we generally think of it, is kind of obsolete in our modern era.
Yeah, I was always trying to come up with ideas for... how could it get any worse? It kind of reminds me of that line, since it's Christmas, I have to throw out a Christmas line from Christmas Vacation, where the wife, Ellen, says, you know, Clark, everybody needs to leave before it gets any worse. And he just says, how can it get any worse? We're in the thresholds of hell. I think that's kind of how a lot of people feel now in the year 2020, where you just wonder, people tend to think of worst case scenarios as being like death. Tending to be the worst thing that could happen to you. And what I've been watching and observing is that I begin to understand why a lot of peoples in earlier times preferred death to surrender or being subjugated, because the humiliation and disgrace and indignity that occurs afterwards, the degradation of just your humanity is worse than death in some ways. Not to get too depressing on that, but I'm just seeing what people are doing to themselves now and what they're allowing and tolerating without actually resisting. And that's where I finally realized that the direction we're going as a society is going to be much different than, like you watch Red Dawn or some film that is about a takeover where it's very direct and explicit. And instead, it's more of this weird psychologically dysfunctional society. But also, I was trying to think of ways that it could get worse. And the problem is that all the context for anything that you can think of is already there. Anything bad you can think of, and that's why I enjoy retweeting a lot of my short stories, the dystopian ones, because they inevitably something similar to what I describe happens. There was the short story Woke Capital that is about, you know, so your apps or your technology basically controlling you inside your own home, which is becoming even more relevant now that people are staying at home because of all this government lockdown stuff.
Yeah, I saw a comment on Twitter to this effect the other day, in that you know, the lockdown's basically destroying public life, enforcing everyone to their homes, has handed a lot of power to tech companies. I mean, they already had a lot of power, but they have even more power. I'll include a link to that short story that you mentioned, Das Volk Capital, in the show notes. But you imagine a future in which people who've their smart appliances have overheard them saying things that are un-PC, to put it mildly. Suddenly find themselves not able to get into their homes. Suddenly find themselves not able to access their fridges, and worse things can happen.
Right. You know, it's funny that the years ago, I think it was 8 or 7 years ago, I was working on one of my first novels that I published, The Stringers. And that concerns government censorship and a new prohibition era, except instead of alcohol, it's information that's the contraband. And I envisioned the censorship being carried out by the federal government through a federal agency, kind of similar to the TSA and stuff like that. And I seeing it play out, what I've realized is what I got a lot of things right with that book in terms of what I was anticipating. What I didn't anticipate was that government would subcontract all that stuff to the private sector, to the quasi private sector. Some people have the audacity to claim are private companies, right? Like the idea that Google and Facebook and Twitter and all these other big tech companies are just purely the result of a free market economy
ignoring all the money they got from DARPA and the like.
Yeah, as if the government has no interest in having millions of people gathered onto four big sites with all this information that they can mine. I mean, what's the point of having the NSA? What's the point of having the NSA's database when they can just go to plant a few people in there? But that was where I was starting to realize that our future is going to probably resemble more. There's going to be more censorship, and there's going to be more authoritarianism. But the government's not going to do it explicitly by itself. It's just going to direct private companies. It's going to be a censorship driven by government through private companies. And that's why they want these big companies in a handful of companies that they can control, rather than I was having a debate with somebody about the whole Section 230. And ironically enough, this was, I believe, a libertarian who's suddenly believes that the federal government is needed to keep the internet open. But they said, oh, we're going to go back to the days where there's all these different chat forums and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, I'm sure the deep state will be devastated.
Oh, God, no. A million chat programs, a million forums, decentralizing the internet, anything but that.
I know, exactly. Yeah. it's so fun. That was part, actually, since we're talking about that, that's what actually got me thinking a little bit about the basis for the Pilgrim's Digress, was this whole concept of how can I put it? There's two things: is that big hyper individualism kind of requires a big government, but also a lot of weird behaviors and fetishes and lifestyles have to be pushed by big government, because if allowed to just, this is where a lot of these kind of fringe radical, you know, live and let live people, they have this dichotomy where they don't want to be judged by anybody. They want to be able to do whatever they want. Well, the problem is that if you're a freak in a society, you know, the fear of being ostracized, the fear of being shunned by people for how you behave and what you do. And so they have to turn ultimately to the government to make sure that nobody is allowed to discriminate against them in any way. And that, we're not talking about the law. We're talking about, oh, you can't exclude them from your organizations. So whenever people are trying to, and this is something that the Pilgrim's Digress tries to look at, is what happens when a lifestyle that was once banned becomes legalized, then it becomes normalized, then it becomes accepted, then it becomes required and mandatory. So, you know, does this raises a lot of uncomfortable questions regarding government, but also, you know, this whole idea that what goes on around you outside your own property doesn't affect you. There's some people who have that attitude of, well, if it's not on my property, it's not my problem. Well, that's not that's clearly not how it works, as people are finding out when they have mobs showing up in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, yeah. When you're told that you have to bake the fucking cake, you bigot. Like, that's the point where it's no longer a private property issue.
So I guess that raises the really interesting issue that the Pilgrim's Digress looks at is one of the things that a big misconception that we have in American history is this idea of separation of church and state. It's not found in the Constitution. It was in reference to a letter from Thomas Jefferson to, I believe, a Baptist church. And it was, he was trying to reassure them that the state was going to stay out of their affairs. But yet that's been turned into this idea that religious content can't be a part of public life or politics at all. And yet if people understand the Constitution as written, the First Amendment keeps the federal government out of state affairs, but states could have their own, I'm not saying they should, but states could have their own churches. They used to have censorship boards. They would censor films. Certain films couldn't be shown. Even local cities had censorship boards. You couldn't have certain movies being shown. So this stuff it would not be unprecedented if it were to occur again. It has happened before in American history. But the whole concept of separation of church and state, it raises a very interesting question that I was asking is, at what point does the state resemble and just become a church in all but name? And the concepts, this is what's so effective about what people are doing, I would say secular progressives, is that they don't ever call their religion, they don't call religion, their gods, they don't call gods, their sacraments, all the tenets of their faith, they use other words to describe it. It's very Orwellian and it's very effective. And once people understand that, you start to realize that a lot of what we consider to be secular society is really just it's very theocratic, actually. And the example of that with that is, you know, you got to bake the cake. You cannot resist our religious beliefs.
It's Flannery O'Connor's Church of Christ without Christ.
Yeah. Right. And so, when people will, I mean, and I've watched how certain things have been prohibited. I mean, and you're the same age as me, I believe. And we've watched as a lot of things that used to be prohibited are now being legalized, or they've been legalized in recent years, and they've gotten to the point where you can't even suggest that we go back to 10 years ago on that issue. Yeah. on so many things where, yeah, it's very I'd say what throws a lot of people off also is they don't understand they when they think of religion, they think of a kind of a traditional religion like Islam or Judaism or Christianity, but people who think of themselves as not being religious are actually very religious. I would say that, for example, people say that the Pacific Northwest is a very it's one of the most secular places in the country. I disagree. I would say it's one of the most religious places in the country. It's just not Christian. It's just a different religion. We don't call it a religion.
It's wokeism. It's washing the feet. It's washing the feet of black people. It's hiring a street czar to to shake down the city government. It's climate change.
I mean, this is what I got a little frustrated is apparently I think it was at a Seattle school district or the Seattle city government, but they were teaching the white people that they were engaging in spiritual violence against, non-white people. And I thought, how perfect would it, like, if only that had happened or I'd heard about that before I'd written the Pilgrim's Digress, that would have been a perfect thing to use in this book, where denying the divinity of Christ is an act of spiritual violence against the believers, right? So they're using spiritual language to push their beliefs. I mean, these issues like, the concept of anti-racism, all these different ideas, climate change, they're couched in religious terms and they have religious connotations. And a telltale sign of a religious belief is the apocalyptic warning if you don't do what they say, right? With climate change, oh, we've only got 10 years to save the planet. And 15 years later, we've only got 10 years to save the planet. And it's a never-ending cycle.
It's like David Bowie's song. We've got 5 years. That's all we've got.
Right. And I would recommend that people look at what these people, the words they use. They talk about cleansing and healing and, you know, what these words that they're going to take on even more and more of a religious connotation and overtly, as I think in the next couple of years. And so when I was working on the Pilgrim's Digress, I realized the dystopian genre is dead. We're living in the dystopia today. This was in 2019 when I was working on this book. I was coming up with the idea. Incidentally, so it's a book about bounty hunters, and I just watched for the first time Cowboy Bebop. So I wanted, which, you know, people think, well, that's that has nothing to do with this book really, but I wanted to write a story about bounty hunters. And the first thing, of course, as a writer is you got to make sure whatever your first thought is about writing a story, it's going to be cliche and it will have already been done. And so you need to just spend some time cutting out all the, or rewriting or changing any of the stuff that you originally thought of. So I thought, okay, I want it to be about a group of bounty hunters. I'm not going to do it in space because of obvious, you know, relation to Cowboy Bebop. I don't really want to do it in the past. I want to do it in the future, but what does the future look like? And I can't make it a dystopia because we're already there. So I thought of what would a post-dystopian society look like? Like, what's the kind of society will come about after this, our period of time is over? Because the consequences and the full effects and the reaction to what's going on today is not going to be felt for probably 20 years. I mean, we'll probably be in our 50s or 60s when the full reaction does, or maybe who knows, that the things can change so quickly, especially with the way that communication and information is exchanged now. But I was thinking of what kind of a society would, what would a reaction to today's behavior be like? And that was the basis for this novel.
Yeah, you're imagining I don't want to say post-apocalyptic. This isn't like some kind of Fallout fan fiction or something. But you're imagining what a society that comes after the society that we live in would look like. And your depiction of it is basically a theocracy. The provisional government is basically the church. Like, the church and the state are one and the same, as you alluded to earlier. And the main character, Amos Cavendish, is he's a bounty hunter, a so-called Puritan, whose main job is to bring in criminals who are violating decency laws. The prologue of the novella has Cavendish performing a bust on a guy who owns a sex bot.
Right. You know, it's funny. I was looking at the cover that Matt did for the book, and I was like, wow, this is a provocative cover. I had a very visceral reaction to it. Like, and then I realized I was thinking about it and go, well, you know, I kind of wrote that type of a novel. I didn't really think about it at first for whatever reason. I think I was focusing more on different aspects of the book. I used sex bots actually as a point of discussion about public morality. I was reading an article about the ethics around that kind of stuff. Like, at what point do you ban these things? And I kept thinking of like the libertarian argument. Well, as long as, you know, they're not aggressing against you, as if there's not going to be consequences of allowing that kind of stuff going on. Like, if your next door neighbor is that type of person, would you want them around? And what's interesting is also I have not read a whole lot about Cromwell's, term as Lord Protector of England, like that time period. I hadn't done any type of research in that. And it really wasn't, this is not a book about Puritanism. It's not a book about the Puritan. It's not even a book about theology. It's more of it examines political philosophy more than anything else. But apparently this is kind of what Cromwell's men were doing during that time period. They were doing busts on people, like for celebrating Christmas, or they were shutting down theaters and that kind of stuff. So I thought it was interesting because I was trying to come up with a word to describe these bounty hunters, like the slang term. And incidentally, that's actually, Puritans didn't call themselves Puritans. That was a derogatory term that somehow, I don't know how, but it ended up being used for some time period as in a neutral way.
Well, it seems to be a running theme with that particular. It seems to be a running theme with that particular branch of Christianity. Like, Calvinists don't call themselves Calvinists; they call themselves the Reformed Church.
Right, right. Yeah, people. There's always what people call themselves, and then there's what other people call them. And the other thing that was interesting about this, I was trying to think of what I was just about to say about the other thing that inspired me to write this book is I've never read the novel, The Handmaid's Tale, but, and
you're not missing anything.
Well, but here's the thing. I know the culture from whence that comes, because the Pacific Northwest culture is very, it is very Puritan, like in terms of like the stereotypical Puritanism. We are a very Puritan culture. It's just not Puritan theology. It's secular theology, but the archetype of what they talk about. And so I want to write a book that actually said, you know, they're always depicting this horror of a theocracy where Christianity is running things and people are under the thumb of the church and it's very religious. And I kind of thought, you know, maybe I should depict that society, but that actually has a moral case for why it is that way. Like, how do you get to this point? It's like trying to understand times in political history. For example, for various reasons, people are discussing Caesar crossing the Rubicon. And I get really frustrated when people talk about it without having any discussion about the events that preceded that. For example, the decline of the Roman Republic, efforts to have it reformed, the Punic Wars, all these other things that led up to the moment when he decided to cross that river. And so people tend to blame the effects or the symptoms as the cause for what happens, rather than saying it is the product of somebody else's actions, and which means that somebody else is responsible for that. Or it's also, if you want to avoid a theocracy, this is, you don't do this stuff. And I think my hope is people read this book and say, yeah, our society today is creating the moral case for a theocracy, whether it's a good idea or not. If I was a theocrat, I would have all the intellectual and moral ammunition that I would need.
Yeah, basically what you're saying is like stuff like the society that you depict in the Pilgrim's Digress, that doesn't arise out of a vacuum. People suddenly don't decide to, oh yeah, we're gonna burn all the porn, we're gonna burn books, we're gonna confiscate all the sex bots. You sort of trace the societal steps that led to that kind of society emerging.
Right. Well, you know what's scary is how many examples of one of the things I'm afraid of is that people are going to read this book and think it was written this year in response to some of the stuff. Like, for example, there was that church that was doing the whole transgender thing with the kids. Like, it was some pastor, whatever, and they converted it into I can't remember what it was, but it was like, that's literally something right out of my book that they are describing as a past historical event. And so it's just been kind of scary to watch a lot of the stuff that I've been looking at. Maybe not so much with the sex bot thing, and it's not trying to be a literal, you know, interpret, not speculative history or something like that. But you look at just how degraded a society can get to where people feel, ordinary people. And I think that that's the other thing, is that Amos is not a fanatic. He's not a zealot. He's not one of those hyper religious people. He's just I envisioned him as being a man who was driven to do what he did out of the fact that there was no other moral alternative.
Yeah, he was basically backed into a corner.
Right, and that's, you know, it hints at it. I wanted this book to be very understated so that people could fill in the blanks for a bunch of stuff, but he's very much a person who was live and let live. And then realized that he was going to have to be involved with what was going on around it. Like, you had a choice. You could either be involved, or you could die, or you could pick up a gun and shoot. And there was that one line, he's describing his friend Ronnie and saying, you know, we were all like that. We were the nice guys. And then one day we snapped and nobody ever saw it coming. And that's something that else, a warning that I would throw out there to people, is that, you know, there's all this talk now. You see, you know, big mouths on social media or whatever, about whatever. If there's going to be any kind of conflict, it's going to be like the guys who are going to start trouble. There's this saying that the most dangerous person in the bar you'll ever meet is the quiet one. It's the one just sitting there sipping his drink. He's the guy who's got PTSD. He's the guy who's got a lot of anger, and he's very quiet. The loud mouths, the guy who are big, loud drunks, they're not to worry about. It's the guy who's really quiet. He's the one that you should be afraid of.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're, and you basically kind of, The book is, it paints a world, obviously, but it's not like some hugely world building type thing. You just kind of set a scene, but a lot of it is detail involves, Amos's interactions with the people he's tasked with hunting down, and his superiors and his family and whatnot. And you get that depiction, right, particularly with his interactions with Jedediah, who is a much younger and more fanatical individual who doesn't remember the turbulent era. The turbulent era being the era preceding this one in the book, an era of social decay and unrest.
Right. And I was thinking, okay, what type of characters are you going to have after this time period? And also, what type of attitude would someone have after fighting in this kind of era for so long? Is you'd have men who are just done. They don't really want to be involved anymore, because even if you survive that kind of a conflict, that you don't want to ever talk about it. And so Amos is one of those who is still driven. I saw him as being this reluctant leader that people might see in various films or whatever, but he's the guy who doesn't really want to lead. He just wants to go home, but his capacities and abilities as a leader are so great that he can't walk away, because everyone else around, and then he sees around him the fact that there is no one else who's capable of doing what he's doing. And people also, other people notice that as well. So they want him to be involved with what the work they're going on. But the problem, like you were saying, is that a lot of them were not alive during this era. So they don't have that same attitude. For them, it's just a historical period. It's kind of like with kids today who were born after it finally occurred to me that there are people in their late teens who don't remember going to an airport without being patted down. Like, they don't know what it's like to live in a pre-9/11
world. There are people in their early 20s who don't remember that.
Right. And so, like, how does that shape your attitude to have never known something or never know? I mean, I was born right before the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War was coming to an end. So I really don't remember the Cold War. And there's an entire generation now that was born well after that. So they don't even know that there was – they don't remember a time when East and West Germany existed. There was East and West Berlin. There was a Cold War going on with Russia that was, really ramping up in the 80s. So people who were alive during that era. And another example I'll give is the internet. I don't really like people using the millennial age group. I think that there's a separate generation for the simple fact that there were some of us who remember the pre-internet era. Like, I remember living in a house with no internet. I remember when the internet was only a dial-up on your phone line, and how big of a deal DSL was. I remember you had a landline, but you didn't have a cell phone. And then there was before that, after that, you have a cell phone, but all it does is text, or you do calls or text. The combination of the internet and social media and the smartphone have completely changed so much of our social interactions. And I would actually chance to say that this lockdown would not be tolerated if it weren't for social media and
the internet,
like all this. There's no way they could have get away with this, because people can still interact with each other online and do all this kind of stuff. But other than that, I don't think people would put up with it but we're coping. Not to be too cynical about it, but people are just choosing to tolerate it for the most part, because they're being given an opiate. They're being given their soma, go on social media, go talk. As long as you can communicate with a human being in some form,
go watch Netflix, go play video games. In 20 years, in 20 years or hell, maybe 10 years, we're going to have an entire generation who won't remember what it was like before you had to put a mask on to go to the grocery store.
I really don't. I'm trying to be optimistic in the sense that I don't want things. Yeah, this is what's funny about our dystopia today. It's very effeminate and passive aggressive, and aesthetically, like it's the tyranny of a psychologically broken people. Because I wouldn't mind necessarily being ruled by a strongman if I had to choose, right? Like if these were my own choices, if I was in a pizza place and, you know, you have to choose one of the pizzas there, I would prefer to be ruled by a strong man who's very explicit about the fact that I'm doing this because I can. I'd rather be ruled by a Genghis Khan type character who's just conquering for the sake of conquering. He's subjugating for the sake of subjugating. And if you comply, he won't, you know, destroy you, but let's not pretend like this patronizing here, put this cloth on your face. It's for your own safety. You know, we're doing this because we care about you. We care about, it's so nauseating to see. And I just find it interesting that there's a lot of other diseases, we'll leave it at that, that are far more deadly and harmful. And yet when people spread that disease, they're considered martyrs. Yet when I don't wear a mask, I'm treated like, you know, I haven't really had any bad encounters myself, but, you know, not wearing a mask is almost like, I'm trying to give an analogy from a prior era, but it's almost like it's
a religious hysteria.
Right. But it's not even aesthetically attractive. I mean, that's part of the problem is there's nothing aesthetically attractive about wearing a mask over your face. It's almost like this sign of submission.
Well, yeah.
In a very strange way.
You can see that present in everything. You remember, there was an incident it was 2 or 3 or 4 months ago. You remember the spate of BLM protests where they were pulling down statues. There was the one case in Bristol UK where they pulled down the statue of a slave owner and they briefly replaced it with a statue of one of the protesters. And it was the ugliest thing imaginable. It's like, It literally looked like a racist caricature of a black woman. Like whoever made it, like, made her lips like comically huge. It was insulting, right. And it was just aesthetic. It was just aesthetically unappealing. That's the kind of thing that this tyranny produces. Deliberate ugliness, which is designed to dispirit you. I mean, I've lived in Eastern Europe for about close to 4 years, and in many places, you know, particularly in places like Armenia and the former Yugoslavia, you can still find evidence of artworks created by the communist regimes there. Now, everyone knows about the commie block apartments. Those are ugly, obviously. But you'll get statues, right, and monuments that are very beautiful. When I was in Gyumri, right, Armenia, I went to the Mother Armenia statue, which is a statue that was built during the Soviet era. And it has in front of it, there's the this was a common motif in Soviet memorials, the 12 hero cities of the Great Patriotic War, World War II, Moscow, Kiev, etc., in these nice, right, little stone tablets with the stars on them. And then you get up to the statue, and the statue is not in great shape because it's not being well maintained, but it's very beautiful aesthetically. You know, I'm not defending communism, right, here, but that was coming from an attitude of, we want to build something better. We want to create beauty for the future and inspire people. What's being propagated today is not inspiring. It's designed to demoralize. It's designed to break your spirit.
Right. Yeah, that's what I find. We're not defending communism here. We're saying how, like, if communists can create good art, then what's our excuse? But yeah, I think the one of the differences also is that the communists were starting out with a country that wasn't wealthy, and, you know, there was obviously the nobility and aristocracy, but for the average person, my guess is that their lives were not that great. And so there was this promise of building a better world that didn't exist, and that was going to, you know, motivate them on some level. And whereas today, what we have is people who are in an incredibly decadent material. Like, we have overconsumption. Like, our poor people are fat. They're not skinny. And so what do you do when you're trying to change that? You're in this dichotomy of where you're claiming you want to make the world a better place, but you destroy everything. And it's the only way for people to understand what's going on in this country today is to realize that there's profound psychological and mentally ill people. To the extent that it's, I'd say, a huge chunk of the population, or at least they've accepted it. Because when you have people turning, you notice patterns. Like, you say, huh, all these cities are basically becoming more and more ugly, and they're being destroyed, and they're turning into ghettos, and they're turning into, like, with the whole defund the police thing, Regardless of how people feel about law enforcement, calling for defunding the police is not the signal you want to send if you want to reduce crime in your city.
Oh, yeah.
But, exactly. but for some reason, I'm thinking, do they not understand that you get past step one, defund the police? What does step two look like? What do you think is going to happen once that occurs? And the fact, yeah, they create ugly art, like everything, which is great for me as a writer, because my competition is far fewer than they would otherwise be. I mean, if I was a writer in the 1920s and 30s, I'd be having to compete with actually good writers, in creating literary art. But I think that was another thing that was interesting. It's not so much, I'd say not a direct correlation, but one of the issues that I think is a strain perhaps from Protestant or Puritanism in some ways is that just because of the way that the Reformation went down and the way that things happened, there is this tendency to fear beauty for the sake of beauty's sake. I think that that's always been perhaps among more extreme issues, but just look at Protestant churches. Like, they tend to be ugly. They tend to not be attractive. Whereas if you look at Catholic churches, they tend to be very beautiful, or at least aesthetically attractive. Whereas Protestant churches are typically a box with a little like add a steeple on top type thing. And I think that's
rented office space.
No joke. I once attended a church that had relocated to a former corporate headquarters that they'd converted. And, you know, I was just, and then I've been in, you know, these cathedrals in Europe, like in England and France and all that kind of stuff. And just that the experience is totally different. But I was talking about that with some, Protestant friends, and there's like this innate reaction to like the idea of having a beautiful church. They're like, well, it's not about that. I was like, it's like, do you want an ugly house? Like, this is not, I don't think that it's a huge part of what's going on today necessarily. And I'm not saying that I also wrote that essay, why Protestants struggle with writing good literature is, which people can read at Terror House magazine as well. Cause that was something I was ironically writing while I was writing this book, which is about a theocracy, in the future. But I think that going back to the whole mentally ill thing, that's the only way to explain what's going on, is just people are mentally ill and they're terrified of beauty. They're terrified of beauty because it's a reflection of the fact that they feel ugly inside. Like, they're just miserable. Just, you know, ugly people who are ugly inside can only create ugliness. They're not capable of creating, great art, because we're also a society that's victim driven. The bigger the victim you are, the more, like, that's the ideal. So, being beautiful and being attractive is almost a crime to an extent.
It's very, we're entering into Harrison Bergeron territory. One example I can think of is, You know that there's the common complaint leveled against the modeling industry that, like, all these super thin models, you know, is unhealthy beauty standards on women, and it's driving anorexia and such like that. I don't have the site on me, but there was a study years ago that showed that as obesity increases in a society, its local modeling industry, the models get thinner and thinner. Like, if you want to help, models in the U.S. were of a more normal size back when the population itself was at a more normal size. But as the average American moved towards obesity, right, models moved in the opposite direction as a sort of a weird twisted parody.
Yeah, that, and I've never quite known what to make of the modeling industry, because my question is always it's like with the fashion industry.
Yeah.
And I see what comes out of that. Just the stuff that they put out is so, who was that one guy? He was in the movie Dunkirk or whatever, but he was dressed up like a woman or something like that.
I haven't seen Dunkirk, so.
Oh, yeah. Oh, gotcha. I think Candace Owens made a comment about it, like, you know, what's happening to men or something like that. And that triggered the whole mob to go after that. But I've always felt like these people are just always trying to deconstruct and destroy what's actually beautiful. And it's obviously not a bare bone, bare, nothing but bone, you know, skinny model, but it's also not, you know, a woman who's the size of Moby Dick. We can find something in between that, but I think they're always exploring, at least today, they're exploring the extremes because we've criminalized the norm. Like being normal, being healthy, being sane is now it's almost like it's a sin. It's a sin to be okay. It's a sin to actually behaving in a healthy manner because it means that you're not a victim. And if you're not a victim, it means you're part of the institutional oppression and, you know, fill in the blank, whatever systemic, you know, you're accused of being privileged or something like that. And so once people understand that, it's actually pretty, it's really effective at just throwing it back and like, yeah, I'm not mentally ill like you are. I'm not insane. Or, you know, if you want to use more terms from the Pilgrim's Digress, just say, I don't subscribe to your superstitions. I don't subscribe to your religion. and seeing how that it's worked a couple. It's interesting to get a reaction out of people when you know someone says, you know, what's your thoughts on this? It's like, yeah, I don't subscribe to pagan beliefs, and just it's the last thing that they expect to hear, and they've probably never heard it before. And so now you're putting it on them to have to explain why they're not a pagan or something like that, because a lot of these people see themselves as like a moral. There are a lot of similarities with the Soviets with these people, but I would say the Soviets would not have tolerated this kind of behavior. I just don't think their society could have afforded it. We're able to, the United States, because of its status as the world's reserve currency and its ability to apparently print as much money as we need, right? Whenever we need a problem, we just go to the printers. We're able to subsidize lifestyles that other countries like the Soviet Union just couldn't deal with. Like, I'm guessing that the sexual morality in the Soviet times was more traditional than what's going on right now.
Well, there was a brief period at the beginning of the Russian revolutions where the Bolsheviks were encouraging wife swapping and whatnot, but that came to an end under Stalin pretty rapidly. There was that famous incident where like a British gay communist wrote to Stalin asking if he would be accepted in the communist utopia. Stalin didn't reply. He just wrote on the letter, "An idiot and a degenerate."
Yeah, when you're getting called a degenerate by a communist, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, the communists actually associated homosexuality with fascism, you know, like, and there is actually an undercurrent of that, particularly in Nazi Germany. You know, Ernst Röhm was a homosexual, you know, much of the, was it the SS or the SA that he headed? The organization he headed was mainly violent homosexuals. And in fact, there was a Soviet official who actually said, I forget who it was. He said, if you want to end fascism, kill every homosexual you find. I don't endorse that, but that's what he said. I didn't say it. He did.
Right. Well, right. I just think that's interesting that people, this is where I get really frustrated with, I'd say, the baby boomer conservatives who are always talking about fighting socialism and fighting communism and all that kind of stuff. And they only focus on the economics. And which, by the way, it's like, guys, and then in the next breath, they start talking about how we need to fund Social Security, which I'm like, wait, or Medicaid or Medicare. It's like, yeah, we've already passed that point where the government is engaging in socialist behavior, but they don't really focus on the fact that we're already past, like, there's the warning, like, we can't let this happen. We can't let it happen. It's like, dude, it already happened. Like, we have far surpassed what. Do we have greater freedoms than the Soviet people? Sure, on some stuff, but. And were their lives not that great? I'm not saying we should swap. I'm saying that in a lot of ways, our lives are much more, I'd say devoid. I don't know. I didn't live in the Soviet era. I would probably want to talk to somebody before, you know, making a full on statement on that. But I think that they're, at least when it comes to the family, they were more traditional than we are today. That's a problem. That's a huge problem. And that's one of the things that this book looks at is like Amos spends a lot of time with his family, or he's talking to his family, because ultimately that's like if the family is broken, your society is going to collapse at some point. And that's why I think one of the reasons the Soviet Union didn't collapse, you know, they tried to do a lot of crazy stuff. And when they first took over, I mean, they stopped using money. Which, brilliant idea. That's up there with defunding the police, in terms of stupidity. But then they realized that you can't have that. They were basically doing like a kind of not a LARPing of communism, but they were trying to have it both ways, but they couldn't have it. They could not have the kind of brokenness that's in American society today and function. We're able to do this because we're able to take out debt and we're able to, you know, we've got credit cards. We've got, all these different debt bubbles that are building up and the subsidizing lifestyles that are not, I mean, there was that, I just tweeted about that last night about the prison convict, like the pedophile that had gotten a sex change operation paid for by taxpayers or something like that. Like, yeah, I'm sure that's something that the Soviets would have been spending their money on instead of something else. It's kind of like that goes back to what I was saying. Like the dystopian genre is dead. Cause like how much more ridiculous can it possibly get than what's going on today? Like either things are going to get better in 15 to 20 years. And my hope is that the next upcoming decade will be a turn in a different direction. But I've also learned to keep my expectations at a minimum as far as that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you think it could turn around at some point, but the problem is, like, I don't think there is a bottom in some cases. You know, like, they hit bottom and then they just start tunneling through on the way to China.
Yeah. That's what's kind of – that is – if there's anything I've learned in the last couple of years is that when you think people can't get any more undignified or they can't endure any more humiliation and disgrace, they just keep – they double down. And the toll that takes on a human being psychologically is you know, you can see it in their eyes. When some sled dogs get picked on by the others or get like, you know, dominated or whatever, they get broken. Where basically they do what they're told. And you can kind of tell that in those type of sled dogs. I've seen one of those before. And it's the same with people. Here's kind of the interesting thing going, you know, with regards to a theocracy is that means that people are also not going to be resistant to some radical, like if a strong, this is why I think a strong man is inevitable at some point in America's history before, you know, it goes the way of the Roman Empire, is that people aren't going to be able to resist. Because if they can't resist this right now, they're not going to be able to resist a guy who comes in and just starts ordering things, basically running things himself. I mean, if people are like, oh, that's, you know, that's a violation of the Constitution. Well, what are you doing to, you're not defending it now. And some people who are, I'd say not indifferent, but they're just apathetic about the just degeneracy that's going on in our society today would turn around and freak out over theocracy if someone were to impose it. I'd say, look, if you don't have the moral courage to stand up to what's happening right now, then you're not going to do anything when a guy is violently imposing a theocracy, or you're going to be dead because it's just going to be you. So that's where I'm not saying that a theocracy is inevitable in American society, but I see that the environment for one is being created. I do think the interesting thing is, though, if that were to ever happen, it would not be from the people leading it would not be in the existing church today, either Catholic or Protestant. They're going to be, and I think for anyone who's read Dalrock, or any of the other religious focused blogs or websites, the church just doesn't have men with that kind of moral courage. Because let's be honest, if they existed, they would be trying that already, or something along those lines. It's going to be somebody who is a convert, who's outside the church and isn't affected by, I'd say, just the moral weakness that goes on. I mean, churches are more or less the culture of nice or the cult of nice. They're not, you know, not to be so cynical about it, but that's just the reality of what it is they don't raise men to be strong and courageous or to be bold. They raise them to be nice people, right? You know, pay your taxes, pat the dog and happy wife, happy life type thing. Like they're not David or Joshua or anything like that.
Oh yeah, exactly. You know, it's you know, I used to read those blogs as well. There's not a whole lot of moral fortitude left in any of the churches.
Yeah, when it's kind of sad. I've had discussions with people. Well, not only that, but how out this goes back to the boomer issue is how out of touch some of the older generation is with what's going on today because they live in their little isolated bubbles. They don't. A lot of them are just. For them, it's kind of like with an example is like Gen Xers who still think that we live in the world of Footloose, right? They think that the religious people are the church is running things and being, you know, listening to rock and roll and talking about premarital sex is somehow a risque, rebellious thing to do in the year 2020. And so so they have this disconnect of they think themselves a rebel, yet everyone else is doing what they're doing. And so the same a different kind of disconnect is with boomers where they don't understand any of the societal changes. So they're still under this impression that most people are getting married at a young age or want to get married at a young age. Like the whole marital issue in our generation, it's if we want to talk about depressing topics, you know, that's another one of those. But another part of that is, just talking about social trends from the 80s, back when people, you know, men and women were getting married at like 21 or 22 or something like that. Talking about that today with people within church culture or religious culture makes people very uncomfortable. And I'm thinking if talking about social norms from 1980 is considered taboo, then we're like, you guys, I don't know what to tell you guys. Like there's no point in having a further discussion because if that's too beyond the pale to have a conversation about, and you're just left speechless saying, okay, this is not going to get solved by these people. If there's a solution, they will not have it. That's just the unpleasant reality.
Yeah. I mean, we're already in a position where, say criticizing gay marriage is beyond the pale. I mean, that's what happened to what's his face, Brendan Eich. He had the same opinion on gay marriage that a Barack Obama did in 2008. You know,
yeah. Well, that's the mental illness that's really going on is this idea, like there's no past. So, one of the things I noticed with people is that they've been showing videos of these Democrats talking in the 90s about stuff that. Today, a hardcore right, you would think they were a hardcore right winger. And if you look at some of the politics, it's hard to compare, but with President Trump, he's portrayed as like this far hard right figure. But if you look at his politics, a lot of it would have been considered left of Bill Clinton in the 1990s on some issues, not all issues, but on some of these issues. And to the left of Barack Obama, but it's all the question of context. In today's society, we've changed so much as a society. If you aren't keeping up, you're automatically going to end up on the right. I mean, it's almost like you've got to paddle upstream or you're going to get swept downstream over to the right. This is where it's interesting to watch a lot of older, or more, I'd say moderate Democrats who are being treated like they're right wingers and they're bewildered because they're thinking, I haven't changed my views at all. And I'm thinking to myself, yes, that is the problem. You aren't changing your views. You're part of a movement or a party or an organization or a belief system that is constantly changing its views. There are no concrete views. And that's kind of the same, I think, self-destruction that occurred initially with the communists. I mean, most of those Bolsheviks, the original Bolsheviks, they all ended up dead. Executed. They were, you know, exiled to Siberia. Very few of the original Bolsheviks that overthrew the Tsar, overthrew the replacement government, actually ended up ruling the country. They got consumed by their own ideology, where they were admitting to and confessing during these show trials. So it's the same dynamic is kind of going on there. That's why I see it also as being on top of creating ugly art, it's also a self-destructive ideology and not sustainable. Something's going to eventually replace it. What it's going to look like, I don't know. That's going to be one of the interesting things to watch for.
Yeah, I mean, I have this feeling, like, I can't describe it, that, like, something big is about to happen. Like, you know, you can dismiss this as wishful thinking or whatever, but I have this overwhelming feeling that, like, what's going on now is not going to last. Like, it may last, I don't know, another year, another 3 years, another 5 years, maybe 10 years, but there's just something. What's going on with not just the social things, but also the medical dictatorship? It's not sustainable.
No. Yeah. I don't see it as sustainable either. It's a question of when it's going to end. And what really frustrates me is that, you know, I'm in my early 30s. I don't want to be dealing with this stuff in my early 40s. If it's going to end, I want it to get over with so we can actually start moving on and onto something else, because the narrative, like, there's a very clear narrative of the world that they're trying to create, but it's a world that collapses the moment people stop it. People that they blame for it stop enabling it. Like, the moment they leave, this is kind of the borderline personality disorder type behavior that we see, where guys like you and me are blamed for all the world's ills, but when we leave, they freak out because we're not there for them to blame us for what's going on, and we're not going to be enabling their behavior, because you need to have at some point, you need to have people who go to work, who pay their taxes, who don't break laws, who aren't sucking out of the system. But when all you have are just parasites who want to be taken care of by government or are eating up social services or whatever it is, that everything just falls apart. You can't, and that's why inevitably that you have to prevent people from leaving. That's why they had to build the Berlin Walls, because so many people were leaving the city and that part of the country, that it was going to collapse at some point.
Oh, I mean, we're already in that process. We're like, you know, with all the border closures and whatnot. And, you know, if you've been following what's been going on with, I don't know if you follow Nomad Capitalist, but he's been tracking, like, all the wealth taxes and stuff that, you know, are being proposed in places like California, and even Arizona is going to put in a wealth tax. So it's like, they're going to make it more difficult for you to renounce your citizenship, to leave the country, to put your assets somewhere else. If you have money, they're going to take it, you know. They're trying to make it as difficult as possible to escape. If not with literal walls, then with metaphorical walls.
Yeah, I haven't really been following that, but it's going to be. I've decided that, you know, I'm not like a super rich wealthy guy, obviously, but I'm also not poor. I'm going to be sticking around my area for various reasons, so I won't be leaving. Because I think part of the problem is one, you can leave. Economic migration or economic immigration always has problems. You can, you know, I'm seeing this with a lot of people who've moved to America. They moved here for economic opportunities, but there's a huge identity crisis that occurs when you leave an area where your ancestors have been for 1,000 years, 2,000 years, or hundreds of years, and you're now in a completely foreign area, and you have to essentially give up a lot of that identity to be part of the culture. And you're also a, you know, in so many ways, you're a Johnny come lately to, you know, America's already founded and created, and it, you know, its basis as a country has already been formed. So you're coming in after the fact. It's like showing up to a party. It's like showing up to a construction, like you're doing a construction job at someone's house, and you show up for the party afterwards or something like that when you actually weren't around. And so I wouldn't be leaving my, you know, going off to some Southeastern Asian country with my money for that reason. But I can understand why some other people will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, hell, you know, a lot of people are moving, you know. Plus, it brings problems. I mean, Texas, everyone talks about Texas is going to go blue. I don't think that's going to happen, but you're going to see a lot of idiot Californians move. Californians are the plague. You know, they're moving to Idaho. They're moving to Arizona. They're moving to Nevada. They're moving to Texas, and they're bringing their stupid regressive beliefs with them.
Yeah, yeah. This is what I another part of the disconnect that goes on is people. The areas that people talk about, people are not, I don't know what the migration is from West Virginia, but people are not fleeing West Virginia, and they're not fleeing all these other states where supposedly, you know, like, not to break it down in a binary, but the red states, people don't flee the red states to go to a blue state. No, nobody's fleeing to California. Nobody's fleeing to New York. And people are not There's this disconnect between the ideas and the pulses that they have in place and their actual behavior. You know, if this was so great, why did you leave? And it's the same thing with frankly, these economic immigrants who come to this country and then they end up just bad mouthing our people, our heritage, our heroes, our history. And I'm like, why are you here?
I remember the first time that happened to me. This is when I was hitchhiking years ago, and I was in upstate New York, and I stayed at a hotel where the manager was from New Zealand, and like all she did was complain about the weather, she complained about the taxes, she complained about the healthcare, and I was thinking to myself, okay, then why are you here? Why don't you go back to New Zealand if it's so wonderful? And then I told this to an Australian friend of mine, and he was basically like, yeah, she's not New Zealand because New Zealand's a shithole.
Well, and that's the thing is I don't listen to what people say anymore. I watch what they do. So when people say all this horrible stuff about, yeah, exactly. You can say whatever you want. But if you aren't leaving, then it's clear that you don't actually believe that. And if you think some area is so great, then why'd you leave there? You know, it's we're getting a huge chunk of people from Seattle moving to my area. Actually, I think it's because of the tourist town. A lot of these, I think, wealthier people who can afford a second home, or they work in the tech world so they can work remotely or something like that. But the question I would ask some of them, if someone from Seattle were to move to my neighborhood, I'd say, like, how did you vote? Like, what made you leave? And if they're basically, because what I've always seen is people say, I voted for this person, but I didn't think that this policy was going to happen, or I didn't think it was going to result in this activity, it result in the problems that it's created. And I'm thinking, this is the problem with the democratic process, where a halfwit can vote. Another thing that's explored in the Pilgrim's Digress.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't want to cut you off. There was someone on Twitter like a month ago who was like suddenly frankly like, oh my god, I just found out that Joe Biden supports another lockdown. If I had known that, I would have never voted for him. And it's like, he's been considering that for months.
I'm amazed. I'm genuinely amazed at the level of ignorance of the rank and file voter who can go to someone's website and literally look up their views on something, and people find it shocking that they believe that. And this is why as I explore in the Pilgrim's Digress, you know, it's a government where only a few people can vote. What was actually interesting, I do have to say, is there's one scene that concerns a young man protesting the voting laws. That's actually based off of a real life incident involving one of my ancestors. His name was Thomas Joy. He was a famous architect in Boston in the 1630s. He built, I think, their first meeting house, but he got put in the stocks by Governor Winthrop because he was protesting I think it was church Paul. He wanted non-church members to be able to vote on government stuff. And I can't remember exactly what got him put in the stocks, but he eventually agreed to, like, you know, not recant, but
just shut up.
Apologize. Yeah, just shut. Yeah, he ended up moving away for a little bit, but he came back as a result of that, because he built some of their places. But that was the interesting thing about. Here's another interesting thought that I really didn't explore too much in this book, but I have thought about it. Is, you know, you're talking about Californians moving to places. We look back on societies, you know, like early New England period or the colonial period, where you had where people got ostracized, they got shunned, they got kicked out of the community. Did they always deserve it? That is a legitimate debate, but that gets at the issue of why you remove people from your communities. You remove them because their presence there is a problem, and this is where a lot of the liberty lovers out there would freak out. But I would say, what do you do when someone whose politics are destructive to everything you care about move into your neighborhood? And we live in a democracy, if we just want to call it that, where they can vote. Like, voting is, politics is violence. We just don't use that word. Voting is a form of violence. We just don't think of it that way. So when someone's is able to vote, they're able to put into an effect their beliefs that are destructive to everything that you care about. whether it's in the community or whether it's just the way of life. So how do you deal with that person? Like the ostracizing and shy. I think at some point we're going to see that in some form. It's probably not going to be overt or explicit, but you're going to have communities where if they know that you're from an area that's like Seattle or you're from Minneapolis, the policy will just be to shun that person. You don't talk to them. You don't associate with them. Because that's actually one of the worst things that can happen to people is just where you're completely ignored within your own community.
It's funny. This a few months ago, we had another one of our authors, David Lowry, author of Bluff City, which you can buy from Terror House Press. He lives in Japan. He's married to a Japanese woman. And he discussed an example of someone he knew who had tried to move to a Japanese woman who tried to move to a rural Japanese village. And she ended up moving out because she was so viciously shunned by the locals. They refused to pick up her garbage. The local garbage men, the local auto shop refused to work on her car. You know, no one would talk to her. So she just moved back frustrated.
Right. That's where it gets a lot of people. And I think that that's also I don't want to say libertarian philosophy, but I'd say with a lot of people who are attracted to libertarianism is the idea that I get to do whatever I want and nobody gets to tell me what to do. But that comes up against the fact that other people get to do what they want to do and they don't have to associate with you. They don't have to talk to you. They don't have to, perform like the concept of freedom of association. And so this is where I've always found it interesting to see people, within the Libertarian Party, I would say more so than anything else, but that, contradiction in thinking of, live and let live, but you need to accept you can't judge me. Or something like that. I think I had that stuff in mind when I was working on this book, like the moral arguments that people would make for or against the idea, all these different ideas. And it ultimately comes down to one of the lines that Amos says in the book where his son asks him, like, what do you think of theocracy? And Amos replies, well, what's the alternative? It's always a question of what's the alternative. It's always a question of what's the alternative. And that's a thing that people also seem to just not get into their thick skulls is that life is about choices, about real choices, not a lot of people like to play dungeon master with reality. They like to pretend, oh, we'll just pretend like this isn't going on and we're going to pretend this is going on here. And then now we can make moral choices. Actual choices that we have with what's going on.
Yeah, that's not how it works. You have to deal with reality as it is. You can't sit around playing, trying to apply your game of Europa Universalis 4 to the real world. You have to work within reality.
Right. And that's where also those type of people are just, I've learned to not really discuss stuff with them anymore because they're very adamant about what they think, but they also don't, they're not the kind of people who may have to make, they're not leaders because leadership is about making hard life choices. It's about having to make decisions, and the people who live in that world would never be able to run anything. I mean, these aren't leaders. That's another thing is that the world is run by those who show up. A lot of people who have an opinion will not show up. So they're not relevant to the discussion. They want to have an opinion, but there's nothing. The world, the country is run by those who run for office and by those who are elected. And so the people want to live in this world of, well, what if nobody showed up for the elections or what if nobody got involved in politics? I was like, yeah, what if we all, had 40 acres in a BMW, right? Or something. They always envision this world that just doesn't, that has no real life application. It also ignores history where they say, They think that something happening or predicting that something's going to happen. And that's another thing I want to say about this novel. I'm not advocating theocracy in this book. I'm just pointing out this is how, I'm raising questions about our society today and raising whether, people say, well, we need separation of church and state. Well, explain to me how we are not currently living under a theocracy under a different name. And also, this is how you create the context for a traditional theocracy to come about. We've already created the moral basis for that. So it's almost like people, it goes back to, they want to have their cake and eat it too. They want to have all these, they want to engage in all this behavior, but not have the consequences of the fallout.
Oh yeah, they're not expecting any kind of blowback. You know, that whole inevitable, the wrong side of history. That's one of their favorite phrases. The wrong side of history, as if history only ever goes in one direction.
The thing about history, it kind of goes back to like Caesar crossing the Rubicon. A lot of people will talk about how Caesar destroyed the Republic, and I just roll my eyes and think you clearly have not read anything about the prior history where. To be in the Roman army, you had to own property, and that was causing problems. Like there was the amount of slavery that was going on. How adding commoners who didn't own property into the Roman army changed how its loyalties were based. The lack of traditional classical virtues that had degraded it to the point where the Republic was already dead. When Caesar, crossed that river, it was already dead in all but name, and he was just giving it the final death blow. So this is an example of where people don't understand something that's driving history and someone who is a part of it. Another, not to get too much into religious stuff, but it's also, I'd say, with Martin Luther, you know, do people see him as causing the Reformation or merely the catalyst for it? If people are looking at the context of it, that's another area where. And I'm trying to think of another example of where someone's not a driving force; they're a catalyst for the conditions that are already occurring.
Yeah, but it's like as Dmitri Devi came up with the idea of men in time, men above time, and men against time.
Right, right. And then there's John McClane. You know, the wrong guy at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah. But anyway, we've been going for a while. I think this is a good place to kind of close out the show. TJ, anything else you want to add?
Glad to see this book coming out, and thanks to Terror House for publishing it, and great job, Matt, on the Matt Lawrence on the cover art. It gets a lot at the themes that are explored in the book. If people are interested in other of my work, they can go to tjmartinell.com. That's going to have links to all my other stuff.
Yeah, I'll put all the links in the description. Yeah, go check out tjmartinell.com. He's on Twitter. And buy The Pilgrim's Digress. It'll be out on Christmas Day, December 25th. It'll be on sale for 40% off, I believe that's going to be the sale. You'll find out more about it then. Additionally, all of Terror House's books are going to be on sale for the Christmas season. We're going to be spreading Christmas cheer. So if you want to pick up any one of our other books, it'll be a great time to do so. But check out The Pilgrim's Digress and all of our other works at terrorhousepress.com. If you want to find my work, of course, it's my website is mattforney.com, and all the links will be in the description, as well Bryden's links. You know, he couldn't join us for the show, but you know, he's with us in spirit all the same. And that'll do it for this episode of Terror House Radio. You can check in every day at Terror House Magazine, terrorhousemag.com, for our latest publications. Our books are at Terror House Press at terrorhousepress.com. Social media links in the description. And don't forget that you can always check out past episodes of Terror House Radio at terrorhouseradio.com. Terror House Radio is produced by Bryden Proctor and presented by Jugs. Intro music by Meme Extremist, Illegitimate Non-Coverandum. Done with the Bastards Grind You Down. I'm Matt Forney with TJ Martinell, and we are out.